All right. Okay. Welcome to SysInternals Primer, the TWC SysInternals Primer Tech Ed 2014 edition. My name is Aaron Margosis with Microsoft Cybersecurity Services. I'm here to present all about SysInternals stuff. So the Windows SysInternals tools, as many of you know, was something that was created by Mark Rusinovich and Bryce Cogswell back in 1996. There are a whole set now of very powerful diagnostic and troubleshooting tools, some of the most indispensable troubleshooting tools that you can get for the Windows platform. They're all free. You can download them. They're easy to use in the sense that you don't need to run installers. You just run them directly. In fact, you can run them directly from the web if you want. So the SysInternals brand became a Microsoft brand when Microsoft acquired Mark Rusinovich and Bryce Cogswell back in 2006. Bryce has since retired from Microsoft. Mark continues slaving away, slave wages. He's now in the Azure group. He left Windows, he's in Azure. One thing that's commonly misunderstood, even within Microsoft, is what is the SysInternals team at this point? So people will send email to the internal SysInternals distribution list and ask if the SysInternals team might consider adding this feature or creating this tool. The SysInternals team is Mark Rusinovich. Okay, he develops these. He gets some code contributions from time to time from a few other people, little bits. ProcDump, Andrew Richards has contributed a lot to. LiveKD has a lot of contributions from Ken Johnson, aka Skywing. But Mark decides what are the features going to be, what are the tools going to be that we're going to release to the world. If you want to know anything about the tools, some of the tools have help files with them. They're kind of small. They have a bit of information. If you want to know what there is to know about the SysInternals tools, the most comprehensive book or the most comprehensive guide is the Windows SysInternals Administrator's Reference on Microsoft Press. It's about 500 pages. It is the most accurate and complete set of documentation there is. Full chapters on the major tools, a lot of documentation of all the different features and tips about how to use them. And in the third section of the book is Case of the Unexplained, which is based on Mark's very popular sessions that he gives at TechEd and other conferences, where he demonstrates real-world troubleshooting, primarily using the SysInternals tools. And these are all real-world cases that either he worked on or other people submitted to him. Now, you can tell that this is the official guide to the SysInternals tools because you can plainly see Mark Rusinovich's name right there on the cover. And if you look very closely, you may also be able to see the name of his co-author. So that's me. It is what it is. I like it. It's perfectly fine. So anyway, for those who are not native English speakers, we did not know about this, but Microsoft Press went and translated this book into other languages. The first one that took us by surprise was this Russian edition. And you can tell right away that Mark was taken by surprise and probably none too pleased because they put our names in the same font size. He was much happier with the Japanese translation. There we go, the Japanese translation, where the Japanese managed to get things correct. And there was much rejoicing. But then, the Korean translation came out. And this is an absolute disaster because not only are our names in the same font size, but as you can see, my name's first. Actually, I have no idea if our names are even on the cover at all. But it might not even be about SysInternals. It might be a book about architecture, for all I know. So I told you about Case the Unexplained. So the SysInternals Primer series is a series of talks that I've been giving, sometimes with co-presenters, and it's a complimentary session to Case the Unexplained. The idea came from a technical account manager named Tim Reckmeyer, who thought, you know, it's really great when you go to Case the Unexplained, you see the cases and you see the troubleshooting process, but it would also be really good to have sessions that focus more on the tools themselves, focus on the tools and their features. He came up with the idea of the System Terminals Primer, and here we are, the fifth time around. We dove deep into Process Explorer, Process Monitor, other tools, and we started digging into how you can use the System Terminals tools to dig into internal structures of Windows. Last year, I tried to cram, within 75 minutes, everything that was new and updated since the book came out in 2011. And that was a bit of a challenge because a lot has happened. There's new tools and a lot of new features. So I could have done that again this year, but it would not fit in 75 minutes, and I didn't want to repeat anything. So for this year, it's going to be about cool stuff and more cool stuff, and the emphasis on cool stuff and more. So let's just get right into it. This is what we're going to be covering, starting with virus total integration. For those of you who are familiar or not familiar, I'll tell you anyway, virus total is a website that This is not working out of range, I guess. Oh, hold on. VirusTotal is a website where you can take files and upload them for free to virustotal.com, and they will scan the files using a bunch of different anti-malware engines, over 50 of them right now. Let me just show it to you real quick. So go to virustotal.com, and you can click on this and upload a file, and then you will get a report that looks like this. This is the report for the Amazon Cloud Player. Zero engines out of 52 detected anything wrong. So all 52 of these engines said this is perfectly good. One thing I want to point out is right here, this SHA-256 number right here, this hexadecimal value. So a hash value is generated by a hash algorithm. Hash algorithm is a cryptographic algorithm that you give it any amount of input, either the content of a small file or the content of a very large file, and it applies a cryptographic algorithm to it and generates a fixed length binary value. And the magic thing about hash values is if you change one bit of the input, you end up with a completely different value out the other side. So it's a good way to get a unique value of a fixed size that's associated with content. You can't predict what a value is going to be, so you can't engineer something to come up with a particular hash value. The reason I want to point this out is because, as you can see, that same value is up here in the URL. So when files get uploaded to VirusTotal, they capture the information, they generate the hash value, they get the report, and then they associate it with the hash value, and they use that for looking up values later on. So you can just submit a hash value, and it can tell you, without having to submit the whole file, yes, we've seen that before, here's the results. So that's the website. That's the public website. VirusTotal also offers APIs, application programming interfaces, so that programs can interact with the site directly. They can upload a hash value and say, have you seen this result before, or have you seen this hash value before? If so, let me see the results. Or you can upload an entire file and have it scan that file. Users must agree to the VirusTotal terms of service in order to use this functionality. So this seems like a perfect opportunity to use Process Explorer to integrate with Process Explorer. Process Explorer is a program that shows you what's running on your computer. And there's a lot of features in it that are specifically tailored to looking for potential malware. You can look to see, are these files digitally signed? It checks to see heuristically, does this look like a packed or encrypted file, which is something that malware often does. And so with Process Explorer's new features, you can actually see what VirusTotal thinks about the programs that you're running. So let's run that. Close this out. So here is Process Explorer, and we can just go through, these are all the things that are running. I can just pick a program like iExplore.exe and submit it. Here's the new virus total entry right here. Submit. And of course, the first time through, you have to agree to the terms of service. And you've seen the end user license agreement that shows up with all the SysInternals tools. This is one that comes from VirusTotal. So it pops open the web page, and you have to read through and make sure you're OK with all that. And then tell Process Explorer, yes, I'm good with that. Click yes. It's a one-time thing. Once you do it, you won't be prompted with that again. It submits the hash and eventually comes back with a number. Here, iExplore.exe, 0 engines out of 50 that scanned it reported a problem. You can click on that link, and it'll pop open the web page and show you the report. And it's doing that just by uploading the file hash. Okay? Now, you can do that for programs one at a time if you want. That might take a long time. So as an option, you can just do VirusTotal, check virustotal.com for everything. It adds a new VirusTotal column, submits the hash for each of those executable images, and eventually comes back with hyperlinks. Excuse me a second. I was just getting my other glasses. I don't know. Hyperlinks. So all of these are showing 000, except for one of them. And I guess this is what people were laughing about. Yes, zoomit.exe shows 2 out of 50 showing a problem. And this is highlighted in red. And you can click on it. And this is an internal version of Zoomit. It's not been released yet. Okay, so here are the two engines which seem to think that there's a problem here. I haven't heard of either of these. And we've seen cases where, you know, there will be false positives from time to time. If you have one or two and they're not engines you've heard about, it might be something maybe overly aggressive. They may have a advanced word of something that the other engines don't know about. But normally, I mean, there was one that was in VirusTotal that was flagging conhost.exe, which is a built-in part of Windows. It was flagging it every single time. So we reported that, and they took that engine out. So probably not a real problem, but this is what it looks like when a problem does get reported. So again, this is just uploading the hash. This isn't uploading any files. Let me show you a program. This is a stupid little program I wrote. It's a VB6 program that I wrote back in 2001. Use this thing to see what process that is. Timer.exe. I wrote it in 2001. This has never been uploaded to VirusTotal, and so it reports unknown. Okay? VirusTotal has never seen a file with this file's file hash uploaded before. And so it reports unknown. Now, at this point, I could go in and click submit to VirusTotal and upload it and generate a report, and then it will save that. And if anyone ever goes back and says, I've seen this file hash, is it good? It'll show you the result that it uploads. I'm not going to do that right now, and I will talk in just a moment about why you may or may not want to do that. So, if you want to do that automatically, though, you can do options, virustotal.com, submit unknown executables, and then anything that reports unknown, Process Explorer will automatically upload that to VirusTotal and generate a report. And I will talk about why you might not want to in just a second. But let me go back to the slides and talk about my clicker here. So that was Process Explorer, which shows you stuff that's running on your system right now. SigCheck is a command line utility that you can use to ask VirusTotal about any files that are on your hard drive. SigCheck is a utility. It's been around for a while, and it originally was intended to look at digital signatures on files and see, is this thing signed by a trusted certificate? Is the root certificate still valid and all this kind of stuff? It has evolved over time to incorporate a lot of other functionality, and now it includes the ability to ask VirusTotal, what do you think about this file? So here are the new command line options were added to support this. Dash V, you say sigcheck dash V, specify a file or set of files or a directory, and it'll query based on the file hash. Okay, again, just the file hash. If you add S, so dash VS, it will upload the file if virus total report's unknown. And then there's dash VR, if you can add the R, and then anything that reports a non-zero value, one or more, it will open up a web page for each of those files and show you the virus total report in your web browser. So why might you not want to do that? Why might you not want to upload files to VirusTotal? There's a few reasons. One is the sysinternals utilities won't do it by default because it can be a very time-consuming and bandwidth-consuming operation when you do that. But another reason that may be more important is, you know, if you do sigcheck-v, point it at a directory, check everything out, upload files to VirusTotal, what are you uploading? Are there any documents in there, any engineering plans, financial plans, personally identifiable information, credit card numbers? You're uploading that to a service you have no control over. That might violate some rules you may need to operate under. Oh, and by the way, VirusTotal is owned by Google. So however much you want to trust Google with your private data is not for me to say. But one other thing I want to say about this, and that is if you're looking at potential malware on your system, and let's say you're the victim of a targeted attack, okay, where they have developed custom malware just to infiltrate your system. If you upload that and create a record on VirusTotal, you may be telling the attacker, we're suspicious about this file. Because they may be looking at VirusTotal, checking to see, has anyone uploaded this file hash yet? And when you do, you're telling them, we're suspicious. You may be giving them advance warning to start taking evasive action. When you're in an incident response kind of situation, you don't want to give the attackers knowledge of what you're up to, that you're on to them or anything like that. So that's the dash V set of options. Oh, and the dash VT is for approving the terms of service on the command line, so you don't have to open up the web page. The first time you run it, if you don't specify dash VT, it will open up the web page and prompt you to approve the terms of service interactively. So this allows you to do it non-interactively. The last thing, the last option is dash U. So sigcheck in the past, when you used it with dash U, you were telling it, tell me about all the files that have not been signed, that don't have a valid digital signature. Show me just the unsigned. With the VirusTotal option now, it will report instead files that don't check out with VirusTotal. So either files that are unsigned, or not unsigned, that are unknown, or that have a one or greater number of engines reporting a potential problem. So let's take a look at that. So this operation takes a little bit of time to generate the hashes. I did a scan looking for potential problem programs in the directory where I store the sysinternals programs. And the only ones that come back out of the entire set are psexec, which reports 2 out of 51. And you can see here 2 out of 51, and here's the URL that you can go to see the report. pskill, which reports 1 out of 52. And finally, vmmap, which for some reason I've never seen that. psexec and pskill get flagged by anti-malware all the time, false positives all the time. And the reason for that is because attackers and malware authors will often bundle psexec and pskill and use them as part of their attack and their infiltration. So we always see that come up. Let me show you this timer thing. If I do sigcheck-v timer, this is what the report looks like for something where it's unknown. Okay, VT detection unknown and no hyperlink to look at. Okay, So that is VirusTotal integration with the SysInternals utilities. New as of, I think, just within the last few months. So the next cool, useful thing, I hope this will be useful to you, is using the SysInternals utilities, generating the output as CSV and what you can do with that and how you can manipulate it. So several of the utilities have command line options that allow you to output the data instead of in a table form like we just saw, in a list form, to report it as comma separated values using the dash C command line option, or dash CT, which does tab delimited instead of comma delimited. And the reason I like that is because Excel really seems to like tab delimited. So let me demo that. And this is supported by SigCheck AutoRun C. AutoRun C is the command line version of the AutoRuns utility. It shows you all the auto start extensibility points on the machine. DU for disk usage and RU for register usage. So if I do sigcheck-ct, SysInternals, this will generate tab delimited output of the digital signature status of everything in that directory. What I like to do with this is pipe this into a utility called clip.exe. Anybody here familiar with clip.exe? Okay, this is going to pay for the entire trip for you, this little thing right here. Clip.exe is built into Windows. It's one of the very few utilities that is built into Windows that's not from SysInternals, it's actually useful. This is a command line utility that takes standard input from the command line and just puts it into the clipboard. So sigcheck-ct, generate all this stuff as tab delimited, output it to clip.exe. It's now on the clipboard. I open up Excel, paste, and it's right there. And so I wrote a little macro that does the auto size and filter and everything like that, and there it is, right? So here now, I find analyzing stuff with Excel, I just use it all the time. I have no idea how to do mathematical expressions or anything like that, but for sorting and filtering. So here's all the SysInternals utilities. Here's the status about whether they're signed or not. So you can go in here and remove all the signed ones. I'm only interested in the ones that aren't signed. Okay, click those out. And here I see there's a bunch of CHMs, help files. I'm not interested in those. So to filter those out, I'm going to go over to the machine type column. Machine type reports, is this a portable executable file that's 32-bit, 64-bit? Is it a 16-bit new executable file, or is it none of the above? If it's none of the above, I'm not that concerned about whether it's signed. I don't care whether a help file is signed. So I'm going to go in here and filter out all the NAs. And here's what's left. Okay? I find this very useful to filter down data very, very quickly. Another one is AutoRuns with digital signatures. So this would be AutoRuns C, dash CT to get the tab delimited. Dash V says verify the digital signatures. Dash A says get all the entries. And this actually takes a little while, so I'm just going to type it in from a file I generated earlier, paste that, okay, and again run the little thing to spread everything out. Now one thing I want to point out here is the entry is the name of the auto start extensibility point in the registry or wherever it is. Many of these are going to be blank. And the reason they're blank is they're not real entries, they're just the headers. So here is the session manager boot execute entry. This is just the basically, if you ever saw the GUI and you've got the banner that shows this is the section you're looking at, this is like a section header, basically. So here is boot execute, here's the entry that's under boot execute. Here's current control set control, here's the entry under that section. Services. So basically what I'm gonna do is I'm going to remove the blanks. Now I'm looking at the actual entries. The next thing I usually do is I go over to the publisher column, Here's all the publishers that it's seen, sorted by not verified or verified, or blank. The blank ones don't have any information about the publisher. So next thing I do here is remove all the ones from publishers that I trust. So Adobe Systems, AMD, Eric Lawrence, the author of Fiddler. Anybody here a Fiddler user? Very cool tool. Hewlett-Packard, Intel, TurboTax, Microsoft. Always trust Microsoft. Always. I always do. A couple other things that came with the hardware. Filter those out. Okay, so now I've got 67 of these rows left. Next thing I tend to do is come over to Image Path, and I remove out all the file not found entries. So here's file not found. The file not found means that there's an entry for it, but it's not there. So it's not running, so I'm not going to be too concerned. I mean, sometimes you look at them and have to figure out, does this make sense that this is a problem? I rarely find that they're worth worrying about. Okay, now I'm down to the list of things that I really need to look at. So that's what I tend to do with AutoRun's C and CSV output. The last thing I want to show you on this, DU, based on the Unix utility for showing disk usage, DU-L-2 says go down two levels from, and then I also want to do CT to get that output. I'm going to look at program files. I'm going to look at everything under program files, down two levels, pipe that to the clipboard. Paste that, sort by directory size on disk from largest to smallest, and now I can very quickly see what's taking up the most space under program files. Good? Okay. And there's also register usage. I'm really looking for cases where that's helped. RU is a utility, I believe I talked about it last year, that does something similar to disk usage, but you point it at a registry key and it looks at all the content underneath it. Occasionally there are cases where registry bloat is the cause of some kinds of performance problems, and RU helps identify where those are. The next thing I want to talk about is access check. Access check is a utility that's been around for a while. It's a command line utility that shows you the permissions on various system objects, file system, registry, service configuration, the object manager namespace directories, other types of kernel objects, some other things. I'm blanking right now for a second. But anyway, it's a command line utility that shows you the permissions. And so a couple new features were just added that I think are very useful. One of them is it now can report SMB shares, or file and print shares. So access check dash H, star says show me all the file and print shares and show me the effective permissions on them. Okay. So admin dollar, another share, C dollar, this one that I created, CCM log dollar. I think it's trying to resolve a SID. There it goes. Yeah, these are some domain entries. So it had to reach back to the domain to get the domain and username associated with a SID. But you can see for each of these that there is read or write or both associated with an account or a group. So admin dollar, one of the admin shares, grants permissions to administrators. This SID that never resolves, it resolves on domain controllers, it's server operators, backup operators, and the interactive group. And it shows all of these have read-write on the admin shares. One thing I do want to point out, most of the utilities that will report permissions on file shares won't report the admin shares because it uses a different mechanism to define what those are. PowerShell 4, I believe, just offered up a new commandlet to look at access control on file shares. It's get-smb share access. And you can use it to report the permissions on file shares. And you can also use it for the admin shares. The problem with it on the admin shares is it gets it wrong. It actually reports a hard-coded list instead of going into the registry where the setting actually is and pulling that out and converting it. So this utility actually goes into the registry, pulls out the value, and reports what's actually there. I asked Mark for this because in cybersecurity, we're looking for misconfigurations all the time. And I just figure at some point, some attacker is going to change the permissions on the admin shares and use that as a way to peek in without necessarily having an admin account. So that's what that's there for. So that is with -H. If you want to see the actual access control list or the security descriptor, you add -L. I'll just do that. I'll do that for all of them. So -H -L *. These are the actual security descriptors in detail. So file all access granted here. On this share that I created just for demo purposes, file all access, built-in users has read data, read extended attributes, etc. So -L reports the full security descriptor. But a more powerful feature that was added was -F. So -F allows you to report the data that you see from the permissions of whatever object you're looking at, but filter out groups you're not interested in, groups or other entities, that you're not interested in. So for example, services, access check -C *. Here's the effective permissions for all the services on the box. Let me just use this as a demo. Adobe ARM service, read and write granted to system account and to built-in administrators, read permission granted to interactive and to service. Okay, so first of all, if I'm looking at service configuration, I'm worried about stuff, I don't care about read permissions that much. Anybody who has access to the box can query what is the state of a service, or how is it configured, or something like that. There's no real security vulnerability there. So to look just for write permissions, and this is not new, this has been here for a while, -W says, show me only permissions that are write permissions. Okay, so now it's filtering down. It's a lot shorter list, system and administrators. And somewhere in here, here's trusted installer. But the thing is, that's still a lot of noise. I'm worried about misconfiguration of services. I don't care if administrators have full control. They're supposed to. System is supposed to have full control. Show me the stuff beyond those. And so that's what -F does. So -F, and then you give it a comma delimited list of either security identifiers, SIDs, or names, just the name by itself, or domain / username. So I can filter out system. Whoops, I need to give it something to look for, look at all of them. So now you see system is pulled out. It's no longer there. Administrators is still there. So let's do system, administrators, trusted installer. If you have a space in the name, you need to put quotes around it, but don't put quotes around the commas, okay? So now, show me the permissions on the services, write permissions only, but filter out system, administrators, and trusted installer. Oh, and S15-32-549. I don't care about that either. Clear the screen, do that again. Okay, now things are starting to stand out a bit, right? So here's all these services, nothing associated with this that wasn't filtered out. MSMP service, the service account MSMP service has read and write permissions on itself. No big surprise necessarily, but these things start to stand out. Okay, you can see that a few other cases where here's one, network configuration operators has some kind of read write permission on the WCNC service, and I don't remember what that is. I'm not terribly concerned about that. But let me show you a case that we found in a cybersecurity engagement. We're looking at a system where we're looking at, so we're working with, trying to mitigate past the hash and other things like that, and looking for security vulnerabilities, security exposure on their production systems, particularly their domain controllers. And one of the things that happens is when you install lots of software, like various software, not naming any names, but legitimate stuff, you sometimes find that the developers who developed it and who wrote the installer were trying to get things to work, and they couldn't get it to work, and so they open up permissions unnecessarily, or they add privileges to accounts that really don't need them. So that's the kind of thing we were looking for. And in this production domain controller, we found the SNMP service granted read-write of some type to everyone. It's like, why would that have happened? And so we used -L to show the full security descriptor of this thing. And we see built-in administrators has all access to the service. They had a custom group. This is obviously fictionalized a little bit, but this is real data that came out. And we're going through, and we look at the first everyone access control entry, query, interrogate, enumerate, user-defined, read control. Nothing there. Those are all read permissions. Then we look at the next one, query, interrogate, enumerate, user-defined, write DAC and write owner. Write DAC is change permissions, the permission to change the permissions on the object. Write owner is the permission to set the owner on the object. And I'm looking at this and trying to figure out, like, what product would have configured the SNMP service this way, the change permissions permission on the SNMP service. It took me a little while because I'm slow. But eventually I realized, or we realized, our team realized, this is a backdoor. This is a backdoor. Someone gained admin on this box and changed this little tiny bit of configuration that's impossible to find. What does this allow them to do? Anything they want, okay? Any authenticated user or computer account can connect to the service control manager on this domain controller, change the permissions on the SNMP service. It doesn't have to be SNMP, it could be anything. This has nothing to do with the SNMP protocol. Change the permissions on this thing to grant themselves more access, then change the configuration of the service to run something other than SNMP, any command line they want as local system. Then they tell the service control manager, restart the service. Now, bang, they're running their code on the domain controller. Then when they're done, they set everything back exactly the way it was, leaving just this little tiny back door unlocked. Now, the thing that makes this back door, to me, I was really impressed. I mean, this is really clever and incredibly insidious because they've gained access and now they don't need privileged accounts anymore. It doesn't matter if the domain admin and enterprise admin accounts have their passwords reset. It doesn't matter if those accounts are all deleted. They don't need privileged accounts anymore. Any user or computer account in the domain can be used to do anything they want on the domain controller. And how the heck would you have ever found this? And now with the new features in Access Check, it really stands out. I mean, it was really obvious after filtering out this stuff. It's like, it just stands out right away. So I'm a big fan of this new feature that Mark added to Access Check. Okay, next, export to XML and the app install recorder. So how many of you are familiar with Process Monitor? Okay, good. It is probably the single most powerful and useful tool for diagnosing and troubleshooting problems on the Windows platform, right? It captures all the registry and file events that are happening on the system, as well as a select number of process events, process starting and stopping, some network events, okay? So You can, one other thing that's powerful about it is you can take the data that you've captured and save it to a .pml file, which captures all the data and saves it with full fidelity. So you can read that file back later on a different system and still see everything that was captured on the original box. That's a binary file format. It's proprietary and undocumented. You can also save as XML. And what that gives you the ability to do is if you need to do more advanced processing, you can programmatically do things with the XML. So what is in the book, we documented you can save as XML, period. We didn't document anything about the schema or anything like that. That's going to be fixed in the new book. And here's a case that we're adding into the new book. So first of all, let me tell you about the schema just a little bit. So here is, you get the XML. The root node is procmon. It has two nodes beneath it, process list and event list. And inside the process list node are a series of process elements that document information about every process that was observed during the trace. In the event list, you have information about all the events. For each event, when did it occur? What was the name of the process? What was the process identifier? The operation? The path, if there was one that it operated on? The result, and then additional event-specific detail. So this is the schema, and now you can do things with that. So let's look at a case. The problem that I was dealing with was a customer that was moving to Windows 7 64-bit. And they had some really old software from, it was 32-bit code from the 1990s. So the 32-bit code will probably run perfectly fine on Windows 64-bit. 32-bit code still runs. The problem was this stuff was developed in the 1990s when the installation programs tended to be 16-bit. Even though you're installing 32-bit code, the installers all tended to be 16-bit. And that's because 16-bit Windows code was the one common denominator that would run on all Windows platforms of the time, including 16-bit Windows, Windows 95, and all the different processor architectures that were offered with Windows NT. So 32-bit x86 code would not, developed for Windows NT would not run on the DEC Alpha. Windows NT DEC Alpha, unless there was an emulator installed and it wasn't installed by default. So by creating a 16-bit program, they could run it everywhere because on Windows NT, there was always the NT VDM, the NT virtual DOS machine that would emulate the environment and allow these 16-bit programs to run. So the problem, though, was when we went to 64-bit, NT VDM got cut. So there's no way to run 16-bit programs on 64-bit Windows. So they're stuck. They have 32-bit code that they want to install, but the installers require 16-bit. So the answer was, okay, run the installer on 32-bit Windows, which still supports 16-bit, and then capture everything it does, and then replicate those same steps over on 64-bit. So how would you do that? How would you capture everything that is happening on the system when you're running the program? Louder. Yeah, Mark pays me to get people to yell process monitor, so. I actually get a penny for every down, not a penny, I get 2%, that's what it is, 2% of every download, I get that. They're all free, of course. But it adds up, you know. Totally, totally lame. Okay, stop with the jokes, they're not working. Okay, so here we are. We've got this 16-bit program. We can run sigcheck and report that, yes, this is a 16-bit executable. So let's fire up process monitor. Okay, so process monitor is now running. We will run the installation program. And this looks, yeah. Brings back memories, doesn't it? Okay, and let me bring up Process Explorer and make sure that last NTVDM goes away. This is NTVDM. I love this. You see that little icon there? Did you notice the 16-bit icon on 32-bit Windows? It's the old Program Manager icon from 16-bit Windows. I love that. Windows 3.0, 3.1. Anyway, okay, so it's done. So we'll come back here, stop the trace. Here's all the events. We've got 147,000 different events, many of which are not related to what we're doing. So let's filter that out. We go to the process tree, and we're only interested in events. Here's the original NTVDM. This is the first 16-bit program that ran. It launched a 32-bit program of some type, which then launched another 16-bit program. So we're interested in events relating to those. So I'll select the first one and say include subtree. That's going to create a filter showing only events related to process ID 2340, 2204, and 2612. Okay, and we can see here registry operations, but many of these are read operations. I don't care about query value or query key. What I'm interested in is what changes were made to the system. The way to find that is open the filter dialog and say I'm interested in category is write. Write operations, so registry reads, registry writes, registry writes, registry key creation, file creation, et cetera. So category is write. Add that. And we can see here now that there's a bunch of operations in the temp folder. Probably don't care about those. Samples, now this, that's a temp file. Do I care about those? We'll have to find out. So one way to get a quick view of what is in here. Oh, actually, one thing I want to do is, some of these operations I don't care about. So here's a create file with a name collision. I'm only interested in successful changes to the system. So I'm going to right-click on that and say include success. So it removes everything except the successful write operation. So now all the successful write operations are captured. Tools, file summary, sort by path. And here we can see all the files that were manipulated. System32ZCH8FAA.temp. That's probably not there anymore, right? That probably got created and then renamed to something else. So this is partway there. It's not all the way there yet. Here's stuff in the user's temp directory. Not interested in that. But I'm on the right path. So what I'm going to do is file, save. And instead of saving in the native PML process monitor format, the PML format, I'm going to save it as XML. Without stack traces, I don't care about that. I'm going to remove profiling events as well. So events displayed using the current filter, save as XML, and I'm going to drop it into this recorder directory. Save. Okay. So here's my log file. It's 904K of data. And I'm not going to open it because it'll freeze IE when it does, which we don't need to see that. But you saw the format. You saw the schema and what that looks like. So what I'm going to do is run a script. And I love using PowerShell. PowerShell and .NET manipulate XML really, really nicely. So get mod list. Here is the main script I'm going to run. And what this is going to do is go through the XML and look for the things I care about. Registry and file operations. So it takes as an input the XML file that I just created and allows me also to say I'm interested only in registry or only in file, but I'm not going to use that. I create two objects. I create a sorted list of file objects and a sorted list of registry objects. I then also get the current user's temp path so that I can ignore operations under the temp directory. I'm not interested in that. I've also seen data going in read and write write operations going to ntuser.dat. I don't care about that, so I specifically get the user hive path, and I'm going to filter those out as well. I have some helper functions here. Get the lowercase value, and then check to see is it under the temp path or related to the user hive path. If so, filter it out. I'm going to use this function to ignore that. I have a helper function add file. Pass in the file. If it's already in the list, it ignores it. If it's not in the list, add it. And finally, remove file. And then I do something similar with registry names as well. So here's where the script starts. I read in. Now, one thing I need to do, I promise I'm going to post this to my blog. I need to make this a little more readable. So I'm using all the PowerShell aliases like GC, which means get content. When you're publishing stuff, it's really good form to spell out get content so you don't have to make people understand all the arcane little aliases and things like that. But this is getting the content of the XML file and converting it into an XML document object, which can then be manipulated programmatically. Saving that as input file. That's the variable name. I then go in and I can look at this XML document. Root node.procmon takes me to the root node. Dot event list gets me to the event list subnode under that. Dot event gets all the event elements. Okay, so now I'm getting the full collection of all the events in the XML file and piping that into this syntax, which means for each object passed in, do this. So for each event, first I'm going to save it into a variable called EV. So $EV here means the current event that we're looking at. And then I look at dot operation. So now I'm looking at the operation element within each of these events. If the operation is create file, I'm going to check to see by looking at the path element of this event if it's something I want to filter out. If I'm not going to filter it out, then I'm going to add that path to the file list, the sorted file list that I'm generating. Same if it's a write file operation. This is modifying a file that already exists. A rename involves a little bit more. So the operation name is set rename information file. And in order to look at this, you need to look both at the path right here, .ev or ev.path, which is the current name of the object that's being renamed. And then the new name is in the detail element. So I go into the detail element and find where the file name actually starts. And if that's something that I'm not filtering out, I'm going to remove the old name from the list and add the new name. So all those temp names are going to get removed. When they get renamed to something permanent, all the temp names get removed from here. Any delete operations, delete always shows up as set disposition information file. With detail set to delete:true. So whenever I see one of those, I check to see, is this something I care about? If it is, I'm going to remove it from my list of files. Okay? And then I do something very similar with all the registry operations. And finally, at the end, I just output the list. So file list keys, and here I needed to filter out because I was sometimes seeing empty entries or C colon by itself, which I don't care about. So just report everything with a length greater than 2, and then output all the registry names. So let's see what that looks like. Get modlist from procmon, log file, run it. And here's the list. Here's everything. These are the objects I care about. Directories that are created, files that are created or modified in all these different locations, Windows System 32, registry entries that got created, etc. So now I know what I need. So then I wrote another script, and I'm not going to go into the detail of it because it's not that important. I will post it. But this is get mod objects from procmon, because I now know the full list of objects I'm interested in. Let me do something useful with it, like get them all together so I can take them someplace else. So what this will do is go through this list, this output list, and collect up all the files and all the directories and create a mirror structure showing all the directories that are created and all the files that went into them, and then also create a .reg file containing all the registry entries that got created. And so this is what this is going to look like. This takes two inputs. The first is the XML name, and then the second one is the target directory where I want to drop this. So I'm going to put it right here in a new directory called results. And I pop open Explorer, and here we are. Here is a .reg file containing all the entries that got created. And here is the directory structure. You can see there's a root directory under C colon, where they drop some include and some samples. I hope you can see this in the back. I need to boost the font here. Program data, this is where it ended up dropping start menu entries. And finally, Windows, System 32, some files got dropped into System 32. Okay? Just by manipulating programmatically XML data captured with Process Monitor. Now, the one thing you want to do is you can now take this onto a 32-bit, into a 64-bit system, but there's some things you want to put in different locations. So anything that went into System 32 needs to go in SysWOW 64 on the target box. My recommendation to make that happen really quickly is you take this over to your 64-bit system, run the cmd.exe under SysWOW 64. The 32-bit version of command.exe, anything you run from any of the 32-bit programs you run from there will get redirected. So any 32-bit program that runs on 64-bit Windows, if it tries to go to System 32, it gets redirected to SysWOW 64. So you do an X copy from here using the 32-bit CMD, it will go into SysWOW 64. Okay? And also, when you do a reg import using the 32-bit reg.exe, it will load it into the redirected WOW 6432 node keys. Okay? So, moving back to more slides. So, I did promise more. This is cool. New feature added to, it's locking up on me. New feature added to Process Explorer, finally. How many of you like to have Process Explorer running all the time when you log in? Right? So this is what I like having it running all the time because I refer to it all the time. I want to see what's running. Process Explorer now creates an auto start extensibility point so that you can just check a box and it will run automatically. And let me show you some details about this. So the way it does it is it creates a scheduled task. Here's the option. Option, run at logon. If you're a member of the administrator's group and you set this option while Process Explorer is running elevated, thank you. Better? Too many machines. Too slow of a brain. Okay, let me start again. So Process Explorer, options, run at logon. If you set this checkbox, if you're a member of the administrators group and you set this checkbox while you're running elevated, then when it executes that thing, the next time you log on, or from then on when you log on, it will also run elevated. So this is a way to get Process Explorer running. Oops. I can't. There we go. And somehow I exited Process Explorer. So anyway, what it created is this scheduled task. And because I was running elevated, it took the option to set run with highest privileges. You have to be running elevated in order to be able to create a scheduled task this way. If you're running as standard user, you can only run, you cannot check this box, and so it'll always run as standard user. But you run it elevated, set the box, and then from now on, when you log on, Process Explorer will start up and run elevated without a UAC prompt. So you're bypassing the UAC prompt with this. PSExec. Last year I talked about the -R option, which allows you to specify the service name and the executable name that it should drop on a remote system so that you can have multiple sessions going on at the same time that don't collide with each other. Mark has finally released that, and so that's available now. Another really valuable feature that was added is one of the problems with PSExec. So PSExec is a utility for launching programs on remote machines or running stuff as local system on your own box. If you want to run something on another machine, you may need to provide a username and password to do that. And PSExec allows you to do that using -u, specify the username, and then -p to specify the password. The problem with that is that what it does is it creates the service on the remote box, and then without putting anything on the wire, and then it needs to send the password to the service so that the service on that remote box can start a process using that username and password. It's not going to be able to do it directly. The problem with it always was that when it did that, it sent the password over the wire unencrypted. So anyone who could spy on the network traffic would see the password in the clear. Now, when it starts the service, it creates an encrypted channel back to the client box, and it now sends the password over that encrypted channel, so it no longer has that security exposure. PSPing has been upgraded to 2.0. It now supports the ability to do UDP bandwidth and latency testing. It offers a new option to do timed tests as well. So instead of just specifying, I want to run this test X number of times, you can say, I want to run it for X number of seconds. It's always had the ability to do histograms of the data it collects. Now it gives you more control over the format of those histograms. And finally, for bandwidth and latency testing, you need to have a server-side component running on the remote box that you're testing between. This now gives you the option to automatically open up firewall ports so that the test can succeed, because with a firewall on by default, it's not going to work otherwise. Obviously, you have to be running with admin rights in order to take advantage of this. Even more, BG Info, how many of you use BG Info to put wallpaper on your system? It finally now recognizes that Windows 8.1 is a proper marketing name. And doesn't it no longer, did it used to report Windows NT 6.3, which is the internal numbering of it? Yeah, so now it's the marketing name, and everybody loves marketing. So, and finally, disk to VHD 2.01, bunch of new features, support for much bigger disks, support for the new VHDX file formats, support for the new WinRE volumes in the latest operating system, and more. So, wrapping up, sysinternals primers. If you want to see sysinternals primers from the past, they are available on channel9.msdn.com at these URLs. This deck ought to be downloadable from the local network here, so you can pick that up anytime you want. Sysinternals resources, so the website, of course, sysinternals.com, which redirects you to the TechNet site. The sysinternals blog, which if you want to keep up to date and know when new features and new tools are being released, subscribe to the blog. Actually, one just came out today. Auto Runs just got a major version upgrade, and so did ProcDump, and he didn't tell me about them in advance, so I didn't have a chance to prepare anything about that. Mark has a blog at technet.com as well, and of course the Sysinternals Administrator's Reference available from amazon.com and finer bookstores everywhere. I've got a couple blogs. Actually, I've got one that I've started contributing to that's not on this list, but not important for this discussion. The first one there, blogs.msdn.com, Aaron Margosis, that's where I'm going to post these scripts real soon. Andrew Richards, who's contributed so much to ProcDump and also does the Defrag Tools show on Channel 9, these are the links to those, and an old article that Andrew wrote about a plugin, writing a plugin for debugging purposes for ProcDump. Related content, some of which, okay, so malware hunting, I believe, is still coming up. Case of the Unexplained, ever popular session that Mark does. Hardcore debugging, who wanted to go see hardcore debugging? I did too. It's going on right now. They scheduled both of us at the same time. Kills me. The Pass the Hash talk at the bottom is one that Mark did, I believe, earlier today at 1:30. How many of you went to that? cool. Okay, so that is a great session. I've seen it in the past. And here's the standard stuff. Anyway, thank you so much for coming. I hope you got something useful out of this today.